hold Roz back. But Roz a big man, and him done knocked down Roz a 70-year-old grandpappy, and Roz with that naked razor in his hand, not caring much who else he had to cut to carve his path back to the church where that white man was. Before God, we tried to hold Roz. That was what he told, because that was what he knew. He had departed immediately. He did not know that at the time he was telling it, the Negro Roz was lying unconscious in a neighboring cabin, with his skull fractured where Christmas, just inside the now dark door, had struck him with the bench leg when Roz plunged into the church. Christmas struck just once, hard, savagely, at the sound of running feet, the thick shape which rushed headlong through the doorway, and heard it, without pause, plunge on crashing among the overturned benches and become still. Also, without pausing, Christmas sprang out and to the earth, where he stood lightly, poised, still grasping the bench leg, cool, not even breathing hard. He was quite cool, no sweat, the darkness cool upon him. The churchyard was a pallid crescent of trampled and beaten earth, shaped and enclosed by undergrowth and trees. He knew that the undergrowth was full of Negroes. He could feel the eyes. Looking and looking, he thought. Don't even know they can't see me. He breathed deeply. He found that he was hefting the bench leg, curiously, as though trying its balance, as if he had never touched it before. I'll cut a notch in it tomorrow, he thought. He leaned the leg carefully against the wall beside him and took from his shirt a cigarette and a match. As he struck the match, he paused, and with the yellow flames spurting punily into life, he stood, his head turned a little. It was hooves which he heard. He heard them come alive and grow swift, diminishing. A mule, he said aloud, not loud. Bound for town with the good news. He lit the cigarette and flipped the match away, and he stood there, smoking, feeling the Negro eyes upon the tiny living coal. Though he stood there until the cigarette was smoked down, he was quite alert. He had set his back against the wall, and he held the bench leg in his right hand again. He smoked the cigarette completely down, then he flipped it, twinkling, as far as he could toward the undergrowth where he could feel the Negroes crouching. "Have a butt, boys," he said, his voice sudden and loud in the silence. In the undergrowth where they crouched, they watched the cigarette twinkle toward the earth and glow there for a time. But they could not see him when he departed, nor which way he went. At 8 o'clock the next morning, the sheriff arrived, with his posse and the bloodhounds. They made one capture immediately, though the dogs had nothing to do with it. The church was deserted. There was not a Negro in sight. The posse entered the church and looked quietly about at the wreckage. Then they emerged. The dogs had struck something immediately, but before they set out, a deputy found, wedged into a split plank on the side of the church, a scrap of paper. It had been obviously put there by the hand of man, and opened, it proved to be an empty cigarette container torn open and spread smooth, and on the white inner side was a penciled message. It was raggedly written, as though by an unpracticed hand or perhaps in the dark, and it was not long. It was addressed to the sheriff by name, and it was unprintable. A single phrase, and it was unsigned. "Didn't I tell you?" one of the party said. He was unshaven, too, and muddy, like the quarry which they had not yet even seen, and his face looked strained and a little mad, with frustration, outrage, and his voice was hoarse, as though he had been doing a good deal of unheeded shouting or talking recently. "I told you all the time. I told you." "Told me what?" the sheriff said in a cold, level voice, bearing upon the other a gaze cold and level, the penciled message in his hand. "What did you tell me when?" The other looked at the sheriff, outraged, desperate, frayed almost to endurance's limit. Looking at him, the deputy thought, if he don't get that reward, he will just die. His mouth was open, though voiceless, as he glared at the sheriff with a kind of baffled and unbelieving amaze. "And I done told you, too," the sheriff said, in his bleak, quiet voice. If you don't like the way I am running this, you can wait back in town. There's a good place there for you to wait in. Cool. Where you won't stay so heated up like out here in the sun. Ain't I told you now? Talk up. The other closed his mouth. He looked away as though with a tremendous effort. As though with a tremendous effort, he said, "Yes," in a dry, suffocated voice. The sheriff turned heavily, crumpling the message. "You try to keep that from slipping your mind again, then," he said. "If you got any mind to even slip on you." They were ringed about with quiet, interested faces in the early sunlight. "About which I got the Lord's own doubts, if you or anybody else wants to know." Someone guffawed once. "Shut up that noise," the sheriff said. "Let's get going. Get them dogs started, Buf." The dogs were cast, still on leash. They struck immediately. The trail was good, easily followed because of the dew. The fugitive had apparently made no effort whatever to hide it. They could even see the prints of his knees and hands where he had knelt to drink from a spring. "I never yet knew a murderer that had more sense than that about the folks that would chase him," the deputy said. "But this darn fool don't even suspect that we might use dogs." "We've been putting dogs on him once a day ever since Sunday," the sheriff said. "And we ain't caught him yet." "Them were cold trails. We ain't had a good hot trail until today. But he's made his mistake at last. We'll get him today. Before noon, maybe." "I'll wait and see, I reckon," the sheriff said. "You'll see," the deputy said. "This trail is running straight as a railroad. I could follow it myself, almost. Look here. You can even see his footprints. The darn fool ain't even got enough sense to get into the road, in the dust, where other folks have walked and where the dogs can't scent him. Them dogs will find the end of them footprints before 10 o'clock. Which the dogs did. Presently the trail bent sharply at right angles. They followed it and came onto a road, which they followed behind the low-headed and eager dogs who, after a short distance, swung to the roadside where a path came down from a cotton house in a nearby field. They began to bay, milling, tugging, their voices loud, mellow, ringing, whining and surging with excitement. "Why, the darn fool," the deputy said. "He sat down here and rested. Here's his footmarks. Them same rubber heels. He ain't a mile ahead right now. Come on, boys." They went on, the leashes taut, the dogs baying, the men moving now at a trot. The sheriff turned to the unshaven man. "Now's your chance to run ahead and catch him and get that $1,000, he said. "Why don't you do it?" The man did not answer. None of them had much breath for talking, particularly when after about a mile the dogs, still straining and baying, turned from the road and followed a path which went quartering up a hill and into a cornfield. Here they stopped baying, but if anything their eagerness seemed to increase. The men were running now. Beyond the head tall corn was a negro cabin. "He's in there," the sheriff said, drawing his pistol. "Watch yourselves now, boys. He'll have a gun now." It was done with finesse and skill. The house surrounded by concealed men with drawn pistols, and the sheriff, followed by the deputy, getting himself for all his bulk swiftly and smartly flat against the cabin wall, out of range of any window. Still flat to the wall, he ran around the corner and kicked open the door and sprang, pistol first, into the cabin. It contained a negro child. The child was stark naked, and it sat in the cold ashes on the hearth, eating something. It was apparently alone, though an instant later a woman appeared in an inner door, her mouth open, in the act of dropping an iron skillet. She was wearing a pair of man's shoes, which a member of the posse identified as having belonged to the fugitive. She told them about the white man on the road about daylight and how he had swapped shoes with her, taking in exchange a pair of her husband's brogans, which she was wearing at the time. The sheriff listened. That happened right by a cotton house, didn't it? He said. She told him yes. He returned to his men, to the leashed and eager dogs. He looked down at the dogs while the men asked questions and then ceased, watching him. They watched him put the pistol back into his pocket and then turn and kick the dogs, once each, heavily. Get them darn egg suckers on back to town, he said. But the sheriff was a good officer. He knew as well as his men that he would return to the cotton house, where he believed that Christmas had been hidden all the while, though he knew now that Christmas would not be there when they returned. They had some trouble getting the dogs away from the cabin, so that it was in the hot brilliance of 10 o'clock that they surrounded the cotton house carefully and skillfully and quietly and surprised it with pistols, quite by the rules and without any particular hope, and found one astonished and terrified field rat. Nevertheless, the sheriff had the dogs. They had refused to approach the cotton house at all. They refused to leave the road, leaning and straining against the collars with simultaneous and reverted heads pointed back down the road toward the cabin from which they had been recently dragged away, brought up. It took two men by main strength to fetch them up, where as soon as the leashes were slacked, they sprang as one and rushed around the cotton house and through the very marks which the fugitive's legs had left in the tall and still dewed weeds in the house's shadow, and rushed, leaping and straining back toward the road, dragging the two men for 50 yards before they succeeded in passing the leashes about a sapling and snubbing the dogs up. This time, the sheriff did not even kick them. At last the noise and the alarms, the sound and fury of the hunt, dies away, dies out of his hearing. He was not in the cotton house when the man and the dogs passed, as the sheriff believed. He paused there only long enough to lace up the brogans. The black shoes smelling of negro. They looked like they had been chopped out of iron ore with a dull axe. Looking down at the harsh, crude, clumsy shapelessness of them, he said, "Huh," through his teeth. It seemed to him that he could see himself being hunted by white men at last into the black abyss which had been waiting, trying for 30 years to drown him, and into which now and at last he had actually entered, bearing now upon his ankles the definite and ineradicable gauge of its upward moving. It is just dawn, daylight. That gray and lonely suspension filled with the peaceful and tentative waking of birds. The air, in-breathed, is like spring water. He breathes deep and slow, feeling with each breath himself diffuse in the neutral grayness, becoming one with loneliness and quiet that has never known fury or despair. That was all I wanted, he thinks, in a quiet and slow amazement. That was all. For 30 years. That didn't seem to be a whole lot to ask in 30 years. He has not slept very much since Wednesday, and now Wednesday has come and gone again, though he does not know it. When he thinks about time, it seems to him now that for 30 years he has lived inside an orderly parade of named and numbered days like fence pickets, and that one night he went to sleep, and when he waked up, he was outside of them. For a time after he fled on that Friday night, he tried to keep up with the days, after the old habit. Once, after lying all night in a haystack, he was awake in time to watch the farmhouse wake. He saw before daylight a lamp come yellowly alive in the kitchen, and then in the gray yet dark he heard the slow, clapping sound of an axe, and movement, man movement, among the waking cattle sounds in the nearby barn. Then he could smell smoke and food, the hot, fierce food, and he began to say over and over to himself, "I have not eaten since. I have not eaten since," trying to remember how many days it had been since Friday in Jefferson, in the restaurant where he had eaten his supper, until after a while, in the lying still with waiting until the men should have eaten and gone to the field, the name of the day of the week seemed more important than the food. Because when the men were gone at last and he descended, emerged into the level, jonquil-colored sun and went to the kitchen door, he didn't ask for food at all. He had intended to. He could feel the harsh words marshaling in his mind, just behind his mouth. And then the gaunt, leather-hard woman come to the door and looked at him, and he could see shock and recognition and fear in her eyes, and while he was thinking, "She knows me. She has got the word, too," he heard his mouth saying quietly, "Can you tell me what day this is? I just want to know what day this is."
"What day it is?"
Her face was gaunt as his, her body as gaunt and as tireless and as driven. She said, "You get away from here. It's Tuesday. You get away from here. I'll call my man." He said, "Thank you," quietly as the door banged. Then he was running. He did not remember starting to run. He thought for a while that he ran because of and toward some destination that the running had suddenly remembered, and hence his mind did not need to bother to remember why he was running, since the running was not difficult. It was quite easy, in fact. He felt quite light, weightless. Even in full stride, his feet seemed to stray slowly and lightly and at deliberate random across an earth without solidity until he fell. Nothing tripped him. He just fell full length, believing for a while that he was still on his feet and still running. But he was down, lying on his face in a shallow ditch at the edge of a plowed field. Then he said suddenly, "I reckon I'd better get up." When he sat up, he found that the sun, halfway up the sky, now shone upon him from the opposite direction. At first he believed that he was merely turned around. Then he realized that it was now evening, that it was morning when he fell running, and that though it seemed to him that he had sat up at once, it was now evening. "I have been asleep," he thought. "I have slept more than 6 hours. I must have gone to sleep running without knowing it. That is what I did." He felt no surprise. Time, the spaces of light and dark, had long since lost orderliness. It would be either one now, seemingly at an instant, between two movements of the eyelids, without warning. He could never know when he would pass from one to the other, when he would find that he had been asleep without remembering having lain down, or find himself walking without remembering having waked. Sometimes it would seem to him that a night of sleep, in hay, in a ditch, beneath an abandoned roof, would be followed immediately by another night, without interval of day, without light between to see, to flee by. That a day would be followed by another day, filled with fleeing and urgency, without any night between or any interval for rest, as if the sun had not set but instead had turned in the sky before reaching the horizon and retraced its way. When he went to sleep walking or even kneeling in the act of drinking from a spring, he could never know if his eyes would open next upon sunlight or upon stars. For a while he had been hungry all the time. He gathered and ate rotting and worm-riddled fruit. Now and then he crept into fields and dragged down and gnawed ripened ears of corn as hard as potato graters. He thought of eating all the time, imagining dishes, food. He would think of that meal set for him on the kitchen table 3 years ago, and he would live again through the steady and deliberate backswinging of his arm as he hurled the dishes into the wall with a kind of writhing and excruciating agony of regret and remorse and rage. Then one day he was no longer hungry. It came sudden and peaceful. He felt cool, quiet. Yet he knew that he had to eat. He would make himself eat the rotten fruit, the hard corn, chewing it slowly, tasting nothing. He would eat enormous quantities of it, with resultant crises of bleeding flux. Yet immediately afterward he would be obsessed anew with the need and the urge to eat. It was not with food that he was obsessed now, but with the necessity to eat. He would try to remember when he had eaten last of cooked, of decent food. He could feel, remember, somewhere, a house, a cabin. House or cabin, white or black. He could not remember which. Then, as he sat quite still, with on his gaunt, sick, stubbled face an expression of rapt bemusement, he smelled Negro. Motionless, he was sitting against a tree beside a spring, his head back, his hands upon his lap, his face worn and peaceful. He smelled and saw Negro dishes, Negro food. It was in a room. He did not remember how he got there. But the room was filled with flight and abrupt consternation, as though people had fled it recently and suddenly and in fear. He was sitting at a table, waiting, thinking of nothing in an emptiness, a silence filled with flight. Then there was food before him, appearing suddenly between long, limber black hands, fleeing too in the act of setting down the dishes. It seemed to him that he could hear, without hearing them, wails of terror and distress, quieter than sighs all about him, with the sound of the chewing and the swallowing. It was a cabin that time, he thought. And they were afraid. Of their brother afraid. That night a strange thing came into his mind. He lay ready for sleep, without sleeping, without seeming to need the sleep, as he would place his stomach acquiescent for food which it did not seem to desire or need. It was strange in the sense that he could discover neither derivation nor motivation nor explanation for it. He found that he was trying to calculate the day of the week. It was as though now and at last he had an actual and urgent need to strike off the accomplished days toward some purpose, some definite day or act, without either falling short or overshooting. He entered the coma state which sleeping had now become with the need in his mind. When he waked in the dew gray of dawn, it was so crystallized that the need did not seem strange anymore. It is just dawn, daylight. He rises and descends to the spring and takes from his pocket the razor, the brush, the soap. But it is still too dim to see his face clearly in the water, so he sits beside the spring and waits until he can see better. Then he lathers his face with the hard, cold water, patiently. His hand trembles. Despite the urgency, he feels a lassitude so that he must drive himself. The razor is dull. He tries to wet it upon the side of one brogan, but the leather is iron hard and wet with dew. He shaves after a fashion. His hand trembles. It is not a very good job, and he cuts himself three or four times, stanching the blood with the cold water until it stops. He puts the shaving tools away and begins to walk. He follows a straight line, disregarding the easier walking of the ridges. After a short distance, he comes out upon a road and sits down beside it. It is a quiet road, appearing and vanishing quietly, the pale dust marked only by narrow and infrequent wheels and by the hooves of horses and mules and now and then by the print of human feet. He sits beside it, coatless, the once white shirt and the once creased trousers muddy and stained, his gaunt face blotched with patches of stubble and with dried blood, shaking slowly with weariness and cold as the sun rises and warms him. After a time, two Negro children appear around the curve, approaching. They do not see him until he speaks. They halt, dead, looking at him with white rolling eyes. "What day of the week is it?" he repeats. They say nothing at all, staring at him. He moves his head a little. "Go on," he says. They go on. He does not watch them. He sits, apparently musing upon the place where they had stood, as though to him they had in moving merely walked out of two shells. He does not see that they are running. Then, sitting there, the sun warming him slowly, he goes to sleep without knowing it, because the next thing of which he is conscious is a terrific clatter of jangling and rattling wood and metal and trotting hooves. He opens his eyes in time to see the wagon whirl, slewing around the curve beyond, and so out of sight, its occupants looking back at him over their shoulders, the whip hand of the driver rising and falling. "They recognized me, too," he thinks. "Them, and that white woman. And the Negroes where I ate that day. Any of them could have captured me, if that's what they want. Since that's what they all want. For me to be captured. But they all run first. They all want me to be captured, and then when I come up ready to say, 'Here I am,' yes, I would say, 'Here I am.' I am tired. I am tired of running, of having to carry my life like it was a basket of eggs. They all run away. Like there is a rule to catch me by. And to capture me that way would not be like the rule says." So he moves back into the bushes. This time he is alert and he hears the wagon before it comes into sight. He does not show himself until the wagon is abreast of him. Then he steps forth and says, "Hey." The wagon stops, jerked up. The Negro driver's head jerks also. Into his face also comes the astonishment, then the recognition and the terror. "What day is this?" Christmas says. The Negro glares at him, slack-jawed.
What you say?
"What day of the week is this? Thursday? Friday? What? What day? I am not going to hurt you."
"It's Friday," the Negro says. "Oh, Lord God, it's Friday."
"Friday," Christmas says. Again he jerks his head. "Get on." The whip falls. The mules surge forward. This wagon, too, whirls from sight at a dead run, the whip rising and falling. But Christmas has already turned and entered the woods again. Again his direction is straight as a surveyor's line, disregarding hill and valley and bog. Yet he is not hurrying. He is like a man who knows where he is and where he wants to go and how much time to the exact minute he has to get therein. It is as though he desires to see his native earth in all its phases for the first or the last time. He had grown to manhood in the country, where, like the unswimming sailor, his physical shape and his thought had been molded by its compulsions without his learning anything about its actual shape and feel. For a week now he has lurked and crept among its secret places, yet he remained a foreigner to the very immutable laws which earth must obey. For some time as he walks steadily on, he thinks that this is what it is, the looking and seeing, which gives him peace and unhaste and quiet, until suddenly the true answer comes to him. He feels dry and light. "I don't have to bother about having to eat anymore," he thinks. "That's what it is." By noon he has walked 8 miles. He comes now to a broad graveled road, a highway. This time the wagon stops quietly at his raised hand. On the face of the Negro youth who drives it there is neither astonishment nor recognition. "Where does this road go?" Christmas says.
"Mottstown? Where I gwine?"
"Mottstown? You going to Jefferson, too?" The youth rubs his head.
"Don't know whar that is. I gwine to Mottstown."
"Oh," Christmas says. "I see. You don't live around here, then?"
"No, sir. I stays 2 counties back yonder. Been on the road 3 days. I gwine to Mottstown to get a yelling calf pappy bought. You want to go to Mottstown?"
"Yes," Christmas says. He mounts to the seat beside the youth. The wagon moves on. Mottstown, he thinks. Jefferson is only 20 miles away. "Now I can let go for a while," he thinks. "I haven't let go for 7 days, so I guess I'll let go for a while."
He thinks that perhaps, sitting with the wagon's motion to lull him, he will sleep. But he does not sleep. He is not sleepy or hungry or even tired. He is somewhere between and among them, suspended, swaying to the motion of the wagon without thought, without feeling. He has lost account of time and distance. Perhaps it is an hour later, perhaps three. The youth says, "Mottstown. Dot is." Looking, he can see the smoke low on the sky, beyond an imperceptible corner. He is entering it again, the street which ran for 30 years. It had been a paved street, where going should be fast. It had made a circle, and he is still inside of it. Though during the last 7 days he has had no paved street, yet he has traveled further than in all the 30 years before. And yet he is still inside the circle. "And yet I have been further in these 7 days than in all the 30 years, he thinks. "But I have never got outside that circle. I have never broken out of the ring of what I have already done and cannot ever undo," he thinks quietly, sitting on the seat, with planted on the dashboard before him the shoes, the black shoes smelling of negro. That mark on his ankles, the gauge definite and ineradicable of the black tide creeping up his legs, moving from his feet upward as death moves. Chapter 15. On that Friday when Christmas was captured in Mottstown, there lived in the town an old couple named Hines. They were quite old. They lived in a small bungalow in a neighborhood of negroes. How, upon what, the town in general did not know, since they appeared to live in filthy poverty and complete idleness. Hines, as far as the town knew, not having done any work, steady work, in 25 years. They came to Mottstown 30 years ago. One day the town found the woman established in the small house where they had lived ever since, though for the next 5 years Hines was at home only once a month over the weekend. Soon it became known that he held some kind of a position in Memphis. Exactly what was not known, since even at that time he was a secret man who could have been either 35 or 50, with something in his glance coldly and violently fanatical and a little crazed, precluding questioning, curiosity. The town looked upon them both as being a little touched. Lonely, gray in color, a little smaller than most other men and women, as if they belonged to a different race, species. Even though for the next 5 or 6 years after the man appeared to have come to Mottstown to settle down for good in the small house where his wife lived, people hired him to do various odd jobs which they considered within his strength. But in time he stopped this, too. The town wondered for a while how they would live now. Then it forgot to speculate about this, just as later when the town learned that Hines went on foot about the county, holding revival services in negro churches, and that now and then negro women carrying what were obviously dishes of food would be seen entering from the rear, the house where the couple lived, and emerging empty-handed. It wondered about this for a time, and then forgot it. In time the town either forgot or condoned, because Hines was an old man and harmless, that which in a young man it would have crucified. It just said, "They are crazy, crazy on the subject of negroes. Maybe they are Yankees," and let it go at that. Or perhaps what it condoned was not the man's self-dedication to the saving of negro souls, but the public ignoring of the fact of that charity which they received from negro hands, since it is a happy faculty of the mind to slough that which conscience refuses to assimilate. So for 25 years the old couple had had no visible means of support, the town blinding its collective eye to the negro women and the covered dishes and pans, particularly as some of the dishes and pans had, in all likelihood, been borne intact from white kitchens where the women cooked. Perhaps this was a part of the mind's sloughing. Anyway, the town did not look, and for 25 years now the couple had lived in the slack backwater of their lonely isolation, like they might have been two musk oxen strayed from the North Pole, or two homeless and belated beasts from beyond the glacial period. The woman was hardly ever seen at all, though the man, he was known as Uncle Doc, was a fixture about the square. A dirty little old man with a face which had once been either courageous or violent, either a visionary or a supreme egoist, collarless, in dirty blue jean clothes and with a heavy piece of hand-peeled hickory worn about the grip dark as walnut and smooth as glass. At first, while he held the Memphis position, on his monthly visits he had talked a little about himself, with a self-confidence not alone of the independent man, but with a further quality, as though at one time in his life he had been better than independent, and that not long ago. There was nothing beaten about him. It was rather that confidence of a man who has had the controlling of lesser men and who had voluntarily, and for a reason which he believed that no other man could question or comprehend, changed his life. But what he told about himself and his present occupation did not make sense for all its apparent coherence. So they believed that he was a little crazy even then. It was not that he seemed to be trying to conceal one thing by telling another. It was that his words, his telling, just did not synchronize with what his hearers believed would and must be the scope of a single individual. Sometimes they decided that he had once been a minister. Then he would talk about Memphis, the city, in a vague and splendid way, as though all his life he had been incumbent there of some important, though still nameless, municipal office. Sure, the men in Mottstown said behind his back. He was railroad superintendent there, standing in the middle of the street crossing with a red flag every time a train passed. Or, he's a big newspaper man, gathers up the papers from under the park benches. They did not say this to his face, not the boldest among them, not the ones with the most precariously nourished reputations for wit. Then he lost the Memphis job, or quit it. One weekend he came home, and when Monday came, he did not go away. After that, he was downtown all day long, about the square, untalkative, dirty, with that furious and preclusive expression about the eyes which the people took for insanity. That quality of outworn violence like a scent, an odor. That fanaticism like a fading and almost extinct ember of some kind of two-fisted evangelism which had been one-quarter violent conviction and three-quarters physical hardihood. So they were not so surprised when they learned that he was going about the county, usually on foot, preaching in Negro churches. Not even when a year later they learned what his subject was. That this white man, who very nearly depended on the bounty and charity of Negroes for sustenance, was going single-handed into remote Negro churches and interrupting the service to enter the pulpit, and in his harsh, dead voice, and at times with violent obscenity, preach to them humility before all skins lighter than theirs, preaching the superiority of the white race, himself his own Exhibit A, in fanatic and unconscious paradox. The Negroes believed that he was crazy, touched by God, or having once touched him. They probably did not listen to, could not understand much of what he said. Perhaps they took him to be God himself, since God to them was a white man too, and his doings also a little inexplicable. He was downtown that afternoon when Christmas's name first flew up and down the street, and the boys and men, the merchants, the clerks, the idle and the curious, with countrymen in overalls predominating, began to run. Hines ran too. But he could not run fast, and he was not tall enough to see over the clotted shoulders when he did arrive. Nevertheless, he tried, as brutal and intent as any there, to force his way into the loud, surging group as though in a resurgence of the old violence which had marked his face, clawing at the backs and at last striking at them with the stick until men turned and recognized him and held him, struggling, striking at them with the heavy stick. "Christmas?" he shouted. "Did they say Christmas?" Christmas, one of the men who held him cried back, his face too strained, glaring. Christmas! That white nigger that did that killing up at Jefferson last week.
Hines glared at the man, his toothless mouth lightly foamed with spittle. Then he struggled again, violent, cursing. A frail little old man with the light, frail bones of a child, trying to fight free with the stick, trying to club his way into the center where the captive stood bleeding about the face.
Now, Uncle Doc, they said, holding him. Now, Uncle Doc, they got him. He can't get away. Here now.
But he struggled and fought, cursing, his voice cracked, thin, his mouth slavering. They who held him struggling too, like men trying to hold a small threshing hose in which the pressure is too great for its size. Of the entire group, the captive was the only calm one. They held Hines, cursing, his old frail bones and his string-like muscles for the time inherent with the fluid and supple fury of a weasel. He broke free of them and sprang forward, burrowing, and broke through and came face to face with the captive. Here he paused for an instant, glaring at the captive's face. It was a full pause, but before they could grasp him again, he had raised the stick and struck the captive once, and he was trying to strike again when they caught him at last and held him impotent and raging, with that light, thin foam about his lips. They had not stopped his mouth.
"Kill the bastard," he cried. "Kill him. Kill him."
30 minutes later, two men brought him home in a car. One of them drove while the other held Hines up in the back seat. His face was pale now beneath the stubble and the dirt, and his eyes were closed. They lifted him bodily from the car and carried him through the gate and up the walk of rotting bricks and shards of concrete to the steps. His eyes were open now, but they were quite empty, rolled back into his skull until the dirty, bluish whites alone showed. But he was still quite limp and helpless. Just before they reached the porch, the front door opened and his wife came out and closed the door behind her and stood there, watching them. They knew that it was his wife because she came out of the house where he was known to live. One of the men, though a resident of the town, had never seen her before.
"What is it?" she said.
"He's all right," the first man said. "We just been having a right smart of excitement downtown a while ago, and with this hot weather and all, it was a little too much for him." She stood before the door as if she were barring them from the house. A dumpy, fat little woman with a round face like dirty and unovened dough, and a tight screw of scant hair.
"They just caught that nigger Christmas that killed that lady up at Jefferson last week," the man said. "Uncle Doc just got a little upset over it."
Mrs. Hines was already turning back, as though to open the door. As the first man said later to his companion, she halted in the act of turning, as if someone had hit her lightly with a thrown pebble.
"Caught who?" she said. "Christmas," the man said. "That nigger murderer. Christmas."
She stood at the edge of the porch, looking down at them with her gray, still face.
"As if she already knew what I would tell her," the man said to his companion as they returned to the car. "Like she wanted all at the same time for me to tell her it was him and it wasn't him."
"What does he look like?" she said.
"I never noticed much," the man said. "They had to bloody him up some, catching him. Young fella. He don't look no more like a nigger than I do either."
The woman looked at them, down at them. Between the two men, Hines stood on his own legs now, muttering a little now as if he were waking from sleep.
"What do you want us to do with Uncle Doc?" the man said.
She did not answer that at all. It was as though she had not even recognized her husband, the man told his companion later.
"What are they going to do with him?" she said.
"Him?" the man said.
"Oh, the nigger.
That's for Jefferson to say.
He belongs to them up there."
She looked down at them, gray, still, remote.
"Are they going to wait on Jefferson?"
"They?" the man said.
"Oh," he said. Well, if Jefferson ain't too long about it. He shifted his grip on the old man's arm. Where do you want us to put him?
The woman moved then. She descended the steps and approached.
We'll tote him into the house for you, the man said.
I can tote him, she said. She and Hines were about the same height, though she was the heavier. She grasped him beneath the arms.
Euphius, she said, not loud. Euphius?
She said to the two men quietly,
Let go. I got him.
They released him. He walked a little now. They watched her help him up the steps and into the door. She did not look back.
She never even thanked us, the second man said. Maybe we ought to take him back and put him in jail with the nigger since he seemed to know him so well.
Euphius, the first man said.
Euphius. I've been wondering for 15 years what his name might be.
Euphius.
Come on, let's get on back. We might miss some of it.
The first man looked at the house, at the closed door through which the two people had vanished.
She knowed him, too.
Knowed who?
That nigger. Christmas.
Come on. They returned to the car.
What do you think about that darn fella, coming right into town here, within 20 miles of where he done it, walking up and down the main street until somebody recognized him? I wish it had been me that recognized him. I could have used that $1,000. But I never do have any luck.
The car moved on. The first man was still looking back at the blank door through which the two people had disappeared. In the hall of that little house, dark and small and rankly odored as a cave, the old couple stood. The old man's spent condition was still little better than coma, and when his wife led him to a chair and helped him into it, it seemed a matter of expediency and concern. But there was no need to return and lock the front door, which she did. She came and stood over him for a while. At first it seemed as if she were just watching him with concern and solicitude. Then a third person would have seen that she was trembling violently and that she had lowered him into the chair either before she dropped him to the floor or in order to hold him prisoner until she could speak. She leaned above him, dumpy, obese, gray in color, with a face like that of a drowned corpse. When she spoke, her voice shook and she strove with it, shaking, her hands clenched upon the arms of the chair in which he half lay, her voice shaking, restrained.
Euphius, you listen to me. You got to listen to me. I ain't worried you before. In 30 years I ain't worried you. But now I am going to. I am going to know, and you got to tell me. What did you do with Millie's baby?
Through the long afternoon they clotted about the square and before the jail. The clerks, the idle, the countrymen in overalls. The talk. It went here and there about the town, dying and morning again like a wind or a fire until in the lengthening shadows the country people began to depart in wagons and dusty cars, and the townspeople began to move supperward. Then the talk flared again, momentarily revived, to wives and families about supper tables in electrically lighted rooms and in remote hill cabins with kerosene lamps. And on the next day, the slow, pleasant country Sunday, while they squatted in their clean shirts and decorated suspenders, with peaceful pipes about country churches or about the shady dooryards of houses where the visiting teams and cars were tethered and parked along the fence, and the women folks were in the kitchen getting dinner, they told it again.
He don't look any more like a nigger than I do. But it must have been the nigger blood in him. It looked like he had set out to get himself caught like a man might set out to get married. He had got clean away for a whole week. If he had not set fire to the house, they might not have found out about the murder for a month. And they would not have suspected him then if it hadn't been for a fella named Brown,
that the nigger used to sell whiskey while he was pretending to be a white man and tried to lay the whiskey and the killing both on Brown, and Brown told the truth. Then yesterday morning he come into Mott's town in broad daylight on a Saturday with the town full of folks. He went into a white barber shop like a white man, and because he looked like a white man, they never suspected him. Even when the bootblack saw how he had on a pair of second-hand brogans that were too big for him, they never suspected. They shaved him and cut his hair, and he paid them and walked out and went right into a store and bought a new shirt and a tie and a straw hat with some of the very money he stole from the woman he murdered. And then he walked the streets in broad daylight like he owned the town, walking back and forth with people passing him a dozen times and not knowing it, until Halliday saw him and ran up and grabbed him and said, "Ain't your name Christmas?" And the nigger said that it was. He never denied it. He never did anything. He never acted like either a nigger or a white man. That was it. That was what made the folks so mad. For him to be a murderer and all dressed up and walking the town like he dared them to touch him when he ought to have been skulking and hiding in the woods, muddy and dirty and running. It was like he never even knew he was a murderer, let alone a nigger, too. And so Halliday, he was excited, thinking about that $1,000, and he had already hit the nigger a couple of times in the face, and the nigger acting like a nigger for the first time and taking it, not saying anything, just bleeding, sullen and quiet. Halliday was hollering and holding him when the old man they call Uncle Doc Hines come up and begun to hit the nigger with his walking stick, until at last two men had to hold Uncle Doc quiet and took him home in a car. Nobody knew if he really did know the nigger or not. He just come hobbling up, screeching, "Is his name Christmas? Did you say Christmas?" And shoved up and took one look at the nigger and then begun to beat him with the walking stick. He acted like he was hypnotized or something. They had to hold him, and his eyes rolling blue into his head and slobbering at the mouth and cutting with that stick at everything that come into reach, until all of a sudden he kind of flopped. Then two fellas carried him home in a car, and his wife come out and took him into the house, and the two fellas come on back to town. They didn't know what was wrong with him to get so excited after the nigger was caught, but anyway, they thought that he would be all right now. But here it was not a half an hour before he was back downtown again. He was pure crazy by now, standing on the corner and yelling at whoever would pass, calling them cowards because they wouldn't take the nigger out of jail and hang him right then and there, Jefferson or no Jefferson. He looked crazy in the face, like somebody that had done slipped away from a crazy house and that knew he wouldn't have much time before they come and got him again. Folks say that he used to be a preacher, too. He said that he had a right to kill the nigger. He never said why, and he was too worked up and crazy to make sense even when somebody would stop him long enough to ask a question. There was a right good crowd around him by then, and him yelling about how it was his right to say first whether the nigger should live or should die. And folks were beginning to think that maybe the place for him was in the jail with the nigger, when here his wife come up. There are folks that have lived in Mott's town for 30 years and haven't ever seen her. They didn't know who she was then until she spoke to him, because the ones that had seen her, she was always around that little house in Niggertown where they live, in a Mother Hubbard and one of his wore-out hats. But she was dressed up now. She had on a purple silk dress and a hat with a plume on it, and she was carrying an umbrella, and she come up to the crowd where he was hollering and yelling, and she said, "Euphius." He stopped yelling then, and he looked at her, with that stick still raised in his hand and it kind of shaking, and his jaw dropped slack, slobbering. She took him by the arm. A lot of folks had been scared to come nigh him because of that stick. He looked like he might hit anybody at any minute, not even knowed it or intended it. But she walked right up under the stick and took him by the arm and led him across to where there was a chair in front of a store. And she set him down in the chair and she said, "You stay here till I come back. Don't you move now. And you quit that yelling." And he did. He sure did.
He sat right there where she put him, and she never looked back neither. They all noticed that. Maybe it was because folks never saw her except around home, staying at home. And him being a kind of fierce little old man that a man wouldn't cross without he thought about it first. Anyhow, they were surprised. They hadn't even thought of him taking orders from anybody. It was like she had got something on him and he had to mind her. Because he sat down when she told him to in that chair, not hollering and talking big now, but with his head bent down and his hands shaking on that big walking stick and a little slobber still running out of his mouth onto his shirt. She went straight to the jail. There was a big crowd in front of it because Jefferson had sent word that they were on the way down to get the nigger. She walked right through them and into the jail, and she said to Metcalf, "I want to see that man they caught." "What do you want to see him for?" Metcalf said. "I ain't going to bother him," she said. "I just want to look at him." Metcalf told her there was a right smart of other folks that wanted to do that, and that he knew she didn't aim to help him escape, but that he was just the jailer and he couldn't let anybody in without he had permission from the sheriff. And her standing there, in that purple dress and the plume not even nodding and bending, she was that still. "Where is the sheriff?" she said. "He might be in his office," Metcalf said. "You find him and get permission from him. Then you can see the nigger." Metcalf thought that that would finish it. So he watched her turn and go out and walk through the crowd in front of the jail and go back up the street toward the square. The plume was nodding now. He could see it nodding along above the fence. And then he saw her go across the square and into the courthouse. The folks didn't know what she was doing because Metcalf hadn't had time to tell them what happened at the jail. They just watched her go on into the courthouse, and then Russell said how he was in the office, and he happened to look up, and there that hat was with the plume on it just beyond the window across the counter. He didn't know how long she had been standing there waiting for him to look up. He said she was just tall enough to see over the counter so that she didn't look like she had any body at all. It just looked like somebody had sneaked up and set a toy balloon with a face painted on it and a comic hat set on top of it, like the Katzenjammer kids in the funny paper. "I won't see the sheriff," she says. "He ain't here," Russell says. "I'm his deputy. What can I do for you?" He said she didn't answer for a while, standing there. Then she said, "Where can I find him?" "He might be at home," Russell says. "He's been right busy this week. Up at night some, helping those Jefferson officers. He might be home taking a nap. But maybe I can..." But he said that she was already gone. He said he looked out the window and watched her go on across the square and turn the corner toward where the sheriff lived. He said he was still trying to place her, to think who she was. She never found the sheriff. But it was too late then anyway. Because the sheriff was already at the jail, only Metcalf hadn't told her. And besides, she hadn't got good away from the jail before the Jefferson officers came up in two cars and went into the jail. They came up quick and went in quick. But the word had already got around that they were there, and there must have been 200 men and boys, and women too, in front of the jail when the two sheriffs come out onto the porch, and our sheriff made a speech, asking the folks to respect the law, and that him and the Jefferson sheriff both promised that the nigger would get a quick and fair trial. And then somebody in the crowd says, "Fair hell! Did he give that white woman a fair trial?" And they hollered then, crowding up, like they were hollering for one another to the dead woman and not to the sheriffs. But the sheriff kept on talking quiet to them about how it was his sworn word given to them on the day they elected him that he was trying to keep. "I have no more sympathy with nigger murderers than any other white man here," he says. "But it is my sworn oath, and by God I aim to keep it. I don't want no trouble, but I ain't going to dodge it. You better smoke that for a while." And Halliday was there, too, with the sheriffs. He was the foremost one about reason and not making trouble. "Yeah," somebody hollers, "we reckon you don't want him lynched. But he ain't worth any $1,000 to us. He ain't worth 1,000 dead matches to us. And then the sheriff says quick, what if Halliday don't want him killed? Don't we all want the same thing? Here it's a local citizen that will get the reward. The money will be spent right here in Mottstown. Just suppose it was a Jefferson man was going to get it. Ain't that right, men? Ain't that sensible? His voice sounded little, like a doll's voice, like even a big man's voice was